Today at Reader's Corner, Jacob Soll, author of The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations.
The book is kind of written as a history of Western civilization viewed through the history of accounting. Because accounting is very complex, and it's an ancient thing, and it's something that the people who really know about accounting, they do it through a historical lens. From the late 19th century on, there was this tradition in Britain of the accountant as this moral figure, this sort of referee. Capitalism needs these impartial referees who themselves don't want to get fabulously rich, but who serve this role. That's something I discovered in history. That's really necessary to capitalism.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In the world of empire building, success is a numbers game. That's the premise of a book by today's guest, Jacob Soll, titled The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. Dr. Soll cites poor accounting practices as the culprit that led to the storming of the French Bastille, the defeat of King Philip II's Spanish Armada, and the epic Enron debacle that was felt around the world. Poor accountability, he writes, has repeatedly led to financial chaos, economic crimes, civil unrest, and worse. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Jacob Soll. He is the professor of history and accounting at the University of Southern California and the recipient of both Guggenheim and MacArthur fellowships. He joins us by phone for this interview. Jacob Soll, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Jacob, I've got to start with your title. I haven't met many folks who are both professors of history and accounting all at the same time. Are you in a small club across academic circles?
Actually, you know, it's funny. There are a few places where that is not an unusual thing. One is the London School of Economics, and their accounting department is filled with historians and classicists and sociologists, because accounting is actually a very complex thing, and it's an ancient thing. It's something that runs in our society, and it's something that the people who really know about accounting, they do it through a historical lens. So it actually makes sense to think about accounting via history. So it's not as funny as it sounds, even though people do get a snicker out of it.
Well, you know, that was one of the other observations I was going to make. I remember my accounting course as an undergrad liberal arts major, and it had absolutely nothing to do with what I read in your book. And I couldn't help but think, as I'm reading your book, wow, would it be cool to take each one of these chapters in Western civilization and teach accounting at the same time you're teaching how these accounting methods and practices arose. In my case, and I suspect this is a majority of the cases, I hope not today, but certainly back when I went to school, accounting was pretty dry, and, you know, all I remember is LIFO and FIFO.
Well, first of all, you actually nailed it. The book is kind of written as a Western civ book, the history of Western civilization viewed through the history of accounting, which is, you can actually do it. I teach a course on the history of accounting. It's also an ethics course. And we talk about accounting, but the accounting students who come in are often pretty amazed at how exciting it can be. A few of them turn to the humanities. Some of them, you know, just wanted to study the numbers and say, what are all these books and why am I reading giant books by Charles Dickens? But the fact is I think it's a bad and dangerous thing that we don't teach accounting this way, because it was taught as part of a huge cultural structure. It was embedded in religion. It was embedded in political science, management, ethics, everything. And really up until the 19th century, the end of the 19th century.
You know, one of the things that I thought of as I was reading, I think it's one of the later chapters in your book where you're talking about there really isn't any modern day Dickens out there today that's bringing life to the issues you raise in your book in novelistic form. The only thing I could think of was Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities, which was 1987 and completely misses everything that's happened, especially in your chapter on recent challenges to accounting. Can you think of anything out there as a humanist that comes to mind? Maybe the great American novel is still to be written when it comes to this subject anyway.
I mean, if you think about the history of literature, especially in the 19th century and in the 18th century too, so many books are about finance. And, you know, Dickens and Balzac, a French author, a lot of them even structured their books like account books. And I talk about that in the book. Culture, until really, for me, very recently, really until, I would say, really World War II, culture, with a big capital C, and even in popular culture, had accounting in it. It was always seen as an essential part of life. In fact, in the old days, if you got a manual, whether it was by Ben Franklin or you could have a Catholic educator, religious educators would explain what you needed to do, for example, before bed. They'd say you need to pray, you need to learn a foreign language, you've got to read, and then you have to do your account books. That has been a tradition since the Middle Ages. For some reason, and I think the professionalization of the field, and I think the 1960s, where accountants were really seen as too square, accounting has been sucked out of our daily lives and put in this kind of often boring box. And that's a danger for all of us, because accounting is central to our lives, and we need to think about it that way.
You know, I'd love to hear what the Association of Schools of Colleges of Business, or whatever their title is, thinks about all of this. They're the accreditors. They're the ones that come in and hold colleges of business accountable. And if they don't measure up to certain standards, I just have this feeling that most of those folks wouldn't appreciate what you're getting at here.
I agree with you. I'm interested in why you think that. I find it odd. By the way, you know, business schools were founded by accountants. The first American business school, NYU, was actually an accounting school. Harvard Business School was founded by Joseph Schumpeter, but also by the great, great business historian and Belgian accountant and accounting historian, Raymond de Ruiver. So if you look back at where these business schools came from, they came out of accounting, and in many cases, out of accounting history.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, they've moved very far from it. Now, Harvard Business School has a history department within their business school because of their history, and they have this incredible book collection. And a lot of this is because Harvard Business School was founded in part by accounting historians.
Mm-hmm. I'm always impressed, by the way, when I take a look across the Boise and the Idaho economy and identify some of the key players in the economy, people who have started up their own businesses and have become very successful. When I drill down to where they studied and what they studied, I'm amazed at the number of accounting majors there are in among the entrepreneurs around our area anyway.
First of all, you hit it on the head. If you want to actually run a business or an institution well, you need to know accounting. And the beautiful thing about accounting is it's pretty unideological. It doesn't answer to economists' theories. It works or it doesn't work. The books balance or they don't balance. You can evaluate something like a house or a car or the value, for example, of a water supply in different ways. But at the end of the day, you know, it's going to come down to some pretty hard numbers in many cases. And so these skills, these just hard-nosed skills, defy partisanship, they defy ideology, and they are practical. And I will tell you this, I just told my daughters, who are 11 and 8, that they will soon be learning accounting. They're learning French, and they're learning all these other things. But I know that in their lives, I know this, that if they are skilled in accounting, not a lot will get by them, and they will do better in life. And I don't necessarily want them to do this their whole lives. It's just a tool that, in fact, every homeowner, every landowner, from the year 1300 onwards, many people said, if you don't know how to do accounting, you will not be able to hold on to your plot of land or your house. While we have let go of that as a central idea in our educational system and in our culture, seems to me, again, something that's really important, and I think we need to get it back on the agenda.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Jacob Soule. He's the author of The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. And that's exactly how I learned about you and the book The Reckoning. Last August, you penned a piece for the New York Times in which you said that average citizens ought to understand the nuts and bolts of finance, balance sheets, mortgage interest, depreciation, and long-term risk, and you called for a good place to start, double entry accounting. Everybody ought to understand it, ought to be part of the curriculum in high school. We took that one step further here at Boise State, and we're preparing a course in financial literacy for students who are not business majors and who have not been subjected to accounting for the purpose of preparing them better for the marketplace. But maybe you can comment on this idea of yours that double entry bookkeeping really does need to be a part of our lives.
Well, first of all, you know, congratulations. I mean, that's what I've been proposing to everyone. And I propose it to people on all ends of the political spectrum, because this isn't just for business people. This is for everybody. And boy, people want to take a mortgage out or a car loan, and they don't understand how the value of money changes over time. They don't understand an asset versus a liability. Some have said, oh, it can be financial accounting or double entry. I think double entry accounting is great, because you have to put in, you know, for every expenditure, you have to show income and expenditure. If you sell a goat, well, you get 3 florins for the goat, but you lose the goat. At the end of the day, your books, the books actually, you know, they do an audit on themselves. They show you if you have made mistakes or not. And it also gives you a sense of balance. There's a message at the end of the day. Have I made a profit? Have I not made a profit? Have I managed things well? Is this sustainable, what I'm doing? For example, taking out this mortgage. And I think a lot of us have found that owning houses and trying to own houses and getting mortgages, it's a lot harder than we thought. So in a country that's supposed to be a country of homeowners, and we know that's not working out so well, we need to first, as Ben Franklin said over and over again, we need to be a country of people who are literate in accounting. And that will just help everyone. And I have been traveling around the country and the world giving that message out, and a lot of people are open to it and a lot of people aren't. So, you know, it's an uphill battle, but if you've started a program like that, you've done a great service to your students.
And your book, of course, The Reckoning, takes this all the way back to the days of the monarchs, who saw accounting as pretty dangerous. In fact, Cicero paid a heavy, heavy price for his recommendation for accounting. Tell us that story.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the things is that people who call for open books and they keep calling for them often meet with a bad end. Cicero, as republicanism was collapsing in Rome and there were civil wars and Mark Antony had taken over, Cicero started calling for Mark Antony's books to be audited. Everybody knew that Mark Antony just kept terrible books. You know, he could, in certain cases, he was a successful military leader, but Mark Antony, that was more dangerous to him than many other things, and he had Cicero's hands chopped off and put in the forum for that. There are lots of cases, you could call them whistleblowers, or just people who want transparency and accountability, they get into a lot of trouble. I should note that there is a bipartisan tradition in American government in which we don't use accrual accounting, real accounting standards in our major government entities and a lot of our local government entities. This is one of the Achilles heels of the American economy, is municipal accounting, which we don't show liabilities on our books, for example, pension funds. And my grandfather was saved by working for the city of Philadelphia. His pension fund saved him from poverty. But boy, if we don't price those things and show them as liabilities on the books of cities, we're going to have more Detroits. And I live in Los Angeles, and I know we've got some problems in our books, and other states do too.
Mm-hmm. Now, Cosimo de' Medici is a great story you tell, because here you have a case of two sons using different approaches in terms of their education, and it pretty clearly shows what happens to the family fortune as a result of the wrong son getting control.
Right. And this is actually really one of my favorite stories. Cosimo de' Medici, who is the famous, really the father of the Florentine Renaissance, considered, called the father of the city of Florence, he himself was an incredibly skilled and diligent accounting, and that's why he was the richest man in Europe, richer than any king at the time in the 1440s. And he did audits of all of his branches of his bank, but he was a man of high culture, and he saw the world of princes arriving, that the world of merchants wasn't necessarily declining, but there are these kings and popes that had enormous power. And so what he did was he trained his eldest son to learn accounting so he could manage the family business and essentially political empire. But he trained the other sons to not to do that because he thought they would have a more cultural role. They would be art patrons and they would work in philosophy and they would do other things. And this didn't work out because the son who learned accounting died. And what happened was is the sons that succeeded Cosimo put the books of the Medici Bank into the hands of managers who they themselves couldn't audit. So as those managers made bad decisions, they didn't know. And so basically, in 1471, it all becomes terribly clear that the bank, the richest bank in the world, has gone belly up because its books hadn't been kept clearly and they'd been taking risks that no one really knew about, and they go belly up. Now, that didn't mean that the Medici went broke. The Medici turned around once they found out they didn't have money. They cleaned out the coffers of the city of Florence, essentially ending the city's dominance of northern Italy or parts of northern Italy for a very long time. And with it, they used it to buy the papacy, and the Medici are still aristocrats today, but Florence did not remain as a powerful city. So it really undermined Florence, the fact that this funny history of accounting education was essential in the decline of the city of Florence.
And King Louis XIV, he had some help from Colbert, not the guy soon to be the late-night show host.
Right. this whole story began actually for me when I was doing what historians do, which is spend a lot of time by themselves shuffling around in archives. And I found all this accounting paperwork. Colbert was a trained accountant, but he taught Louis XIV accounting and made these beautiful golden account books for him. And this was almost a joke for me. And I tell this story all the time. Here's this king who's famous for Versailles, wearing wigs and golden shoes and dancing in ballet. And he was famous for going to war and building luxury items. But he began his reign fascinated by accounting. He learned double entry accounting, and it gave him incredible skill. The problem was that once Colbert died, Louis started getting more and more into debt. And this is a problem that happens. Studies have shown that people who get into debt often stop keeping their accounts because they don't want bad news. It's a kind of human nature thing. And I think we all know what that feels like. And what happened was he had started developing an incredible system within the state for accountability. So the person running the state could actually manage the state well. But he realized that he could be held accountable if anyone got a hold of the state accounts. So he destroyed the system. He destroyed the system by which financial information went on a clear path through the state to the very top and where everyone got audited and where there was a clear balance sheet at the end of, you know, actually on Fridays when he would hold his meetings with his ministers. So that was a tragic story because when Louis XIV destroyed that system within the state, no one else ever rebuilt it. It's very hard to build systems of transparency and accountability. People resist them. And France struggled. It was basically, when he died, it was bankrupt. It was bankrupt throughout the 18th century, and the French Revolution was the outcome of that.
And I believe you point out that the French Revolution was really a fight over accounting, and there's one gentleman in particular that was central to that, Jacques Necker.
Well, the first shots of the French Revolution, there are many reasons. Everyone tries to make their historical career by claiming they know the sources of the French Revolution, but I can tell you this, accounting was central. It was front and center throughout the whole thing. One of the first great arguments that led to the revolution was an argument about whether one should publish state accounts. And one minister, without telling King Louis XVI that he was going to do it, published the state accounts. And then other ministers said, hey, your numbers are wrong. And this led to a huge argument about whether there was a deficit or a surplus. We can recognize that argument. And then some ministers within the government started leaking government numbers. No one had ever seen, by the way, a state budget in France, a real one, ever. In fact, when they started printing them, they said, we've never even printed a state budget up, a state balance sheet. We don't even know how to do it. When the revolution happened, one of the biggest reforms they did was they built a huge accounting system, and they built a Bureau of Accountability, and they spent a lot of money training people to do it. And from what I've seen in historical evidence, corruption went way down, and for a time, because, you know, you have to always be vigilant and always reform, and for a time, the state worked much better and much more clearly. So one of the great achievements of the French Revolution was this accountability system in which every person that worked for the state had to show their receipts and basically print up a little account of every political act that they had done. So the language of government, of being a member of the government, was this language of accountability through publishing your accounts all the time.
Today we're talking about the book, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. My guest is Jacob Soul, its author. You mentioned Benjamin Franklin earlier, skipping over to America, and in the spirit of equal rights for women, he had an idea, and how did it fly?
Well, first of all, Franklin is, everyone says Franklin's a genius, and you know, you can shake your head to that. And I went in to study his thoughts about accounting because he had written about it, and I was blown away at what a visionary this guy was. Before there was America, it was a British colony. He knew that there was a country brewing here, which is already pretty visionary. And he thought, if this country's going to work, everyone's got to know accounting. Everyone should know accounting, but women should know accounting too. And he said, if women not only know accounting, but take part in economic life, you'll do better. So he said, always make sure when you're hiring someone that their wife is financially literate too. Their household will be more stable, and the woman can actually become involved with business matters. Now, he didn't fully do that with his own wife, and one of the things we know with great thinkers is they don't always practice what they preach. But what he did preach made a lot of sense. It was really incredible. And also to note, many of the founding fathers were accountants, Hamilton in particular. And this was really key to building the American state, and at a time when America was threatened by massive debt, much worse than our debt today. We owed France £3 million, and we owed the Dutch as well. But the French were just saying, look, if you can't pay us back, we'll just take a part of your country in return. We'll literally take a part of America. So Hamilton and Morris and others built the U.S. Treasury to collect taxes so they could say, look, we're good on our debt. You don't take the country. You'll just, you know, we'll take credit from you guys, and we'll have credit in the world, and people will believe us. And so these accountants built this system by which the world trusted America to pay its debts and therefore would loan America money so it could build a military and function as a major country. It's an amazing story as far as I'm concerned.
Exactly. You know, if I could recommend to our listeners one chapter of your book, and that's not easy to do because I just think it's so fascinating to follow accountancy through the pages of history, but the chapter on Judgment Day, about modern-day accounting, you walk the reader through the history of how the British tradition of the accountant as the impartial referee, which was espoused by Arthur Lowes Dickinson at the outset of the 20th century and practiced by Price Waterhouse in those early days, morphed into what would become eventually the Arthur Anderson demise. Could you explain how that works? What changed over the years? You've done it so well in that chapter.
Well, you know, this is a disaster for our country. As we've seen, huge companies went under in the 1990s due to accounting fraud, and they were helped by one of the most respected giant accounting firms in the country, which is, they're trying to resurrect it now, but, you know, it went out of business, and it was convicted of accounting fraud in Texas court, I believe. Basically, accountants from the late 19th century on, there was this tradition in Britain of the accountant as this kind of gentleman, this moral figure, this sort of referee who would come in and bring clarity to things. And it was seen as a kind of really important role in society, an honorable role that you would have, that you would come in. For example, John Moody, who founded Moody's, which is today questioned by many people. Well, he founded the company because no one trusted railroad companies because they were just fiddling with their stocks and robbing people left and right. And he said, I'm going to go out and I'm going to go across the railroad and I'm basically going to do an audit of what its costs and expenditures and incomes are. And I'm going to write an independent report. So you got Dickinson, you got Moody, these guys, they saw it as an honorable thing to do, something that brought light and science to and reason to life. And what happens is that starts to slip away when accounting starts to be seen really as a competitive business to make large profits. Now, no one is going to knock someone for creating a successful business and creating jobs. The problem is it's not exactly accounting's role to be ultra-competitive. That's the problem. And what happened was accounting companies, especially under Anderson, started competing for contracts, every company needs an auditor to go through their books and give them a balance sheet. After World War II, we made a law that you have to have a balance sheet. They could be clearer today, but what we have is better than nothing. Well, we need better standards. So every accounting company wants to get these contracts. But what they did on the side is they said, look, we'll do consulting for you. We'll make even more money doing that. And at the same time, we'll audit your books. So what they started doing was they started working with the companies, not to audit them, but to make money with them. And when these roles got blurred, it undermined the accounting industry. And the role of the accountant as this kind of impartial person who had sort of honor disappeared, and it became, this competitive person who wanted to make more money by any means. And the fact is that capitalism needs these impartial referees who themselves don't want to get fabulously rich, but who serve this role as referees. That's something I discovered in history. That's really necessary to capitalism.
You know, there's another aspect to that chapter that reminds me of that old saw, we're supposed to learn from our past mistakes. And that was President Clinton signing a bill that Senator Graham and Congressman Leach, a bipartisan effort, enacted during Clinton's administration that apparently played a fairly significant role in cozying up these investment banks with practices that would eventually bring them down.
Yeah, I have worked with a lot of the people involved in those decisions. I mean, I've been in rooms with them where they have defended this. I have worked with people that said, oh, don't bring up that old thing of repealing Glass-Steagall. Everybody says that's the reason this happened. And I said, well, if it's not such a big deal, why don't we just put it back, right? It was supposed to make our financial companies more competitive worldwide. But what it really did was it made our banks into giant risk takers with your money without actually telling you. Instead of having a deposit bank where you deposit your money and you get your interest and the bank gives out these kind of local loans which are pretty solid, into these kind of massive financial businesses which take massive risks around the world. No one can even audit these companies. That was not a great thing in my opinion. It made it very, very hard to audit banks. It made it hard for people to understand, for example, the risks they were taking by even using banks, and it undermined our financial system. You know that banks, as a friend of mine wrote in her book, Anat Admati, The Banker's New Clothes, she writes that they're the only companies in the world that don't really have capitalization. Most of the money that banks take their risks with is your deposit money and also the guarantee that the federal government will bail them out. You can't do that in another business. So our banking sector is not following the basic rules of capitalism. And you don't have to be right or left-wing to believe in this. If you want to run a company, you've got to get capital investment that you can build and invest yourself with and pay people in payrolls. Banks don't do that. They take money that was deposited, and they take risks without capital to back them up. We need transparency and accounting reform. We've done a little bit. We need to do a lot more. For that, the public needs to be involved, and they have to understand accounting to ask the right questions.
And the place to start is the book, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. We've been talking today with Jacob Sohl, its author. Jacob, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much, Bob. I appreciate it very much.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Jacob Sohl. Next week, Mary Pylon, author of The Monopolists, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. To listen to previous interviews anytime, download our free player from the iTunes App Store. Search for Reader's Corner.